Thank you, Professor Glahey. To start of this talk, I should point out that when I describe what I have to say as an Austrian approach to competition in the market process, I'm going to be using the term Austrian in a rather broader sense than it is sometimes used. Very often we use the term Austrian to refer to a rather narrow group of disciples and followers of the works principally of Professors Mises and Hayek. But in fact, what I will be trying to describe as the Austrian approach to competition and market process is an approach which is shared by Austrians of a rather broader sense. People like the late Professor Schumpeter, who was Austrian by birth and training, but certainly no Misesian by any stress of imagination. Or someone like my late colleague, Professor Oscar Morgenstern, who, while he did have a good deal of understanding of Misesian economics, would certainly not describe himself as a Misesian. Both of these, both Schumpeter and Morgenstern, I think, would agree with most of what I will be describing today as the Austrian approach to questions of competition and market process. But let me first outline what I take to be the standard approach to competition, outline some of the difficulties which I think are to be discovered in that position, and then proceed from there by contrast to put before you an Austrian approach. The standard approach to competition sees competition as a state of affairs. A competitive state of affairs is one, in standard economics, in which each individual participant in the market finds a price at which he is able to buy and sell, and that price is, from his point of view, invariant to the quantities that he may wish to buy or may wish to sell. Perfect competition refers to a situation where each buyer confronts a perfectly horizontal supply curve, a perfectly elastic supply curve, so that at the price, the individual finds that he can buy this quantity he wants, or that quantity he wants, or that quantity he wants, but all at the same price. Or, if he's a seller, he finds a perfectly elastic demand curve indicating that he can sell this quantity, or this quantity, or this quantity without having to lower the price. And competition refers to this state of affairs, a state of affairs where, it, in fact, there prevails these conditions. Now, our textbooks spell out in detail the requirements for the state of affairs to prevail. Many buyers, many sellers, uniform commodity, perfect knowledge. All of these things are conditions, the presence of which signifies the existence of the state of affairs. Now, this state of affairs is, of course, a state of equilibrium. It is only in equilibrium that it is true that individuals can buy as much as they want or without having to offer higher prices. It's only in equilibrium that individuals can sell as much as they want without having to lower the price. And in fact, a theory of perfect competition is, of course, a theory of equilibrium. So these are the two features, I would say, of the standard approach that I would like to single out. The competitive market, as it is analyzed in standard microeconomics, is a market which is perceived as being competitive in the sense of describing a situation as opposed to, as we shall see, describing a process. And second, that situation is understood to be and is, in fact, spelled out to be a state of equilibrium. Equilibrium meaning a state where no decisions, no plans can fail to be carried out. All plans can be successfully carried out as planned. Any buyer wishing to buy some quantity at a particular price finds he can do so. Any seller wishing to sell at the going equilibrium price finds he can do so. Those are the conditions for equilibrium, and it is only under equilibrium conditions that the state of perfect competition prevails. This is the theory of competition that fills up the theory chapters in our basic textbooks, intermediate textbooks, and advanced textbooks. And there are certain difficulties. One difficulty is that when undergraduates come into our classes as freshmen, or as sophomores, and we teach them competitive theory, there is a certain terminological difficulty that has to be overcome. Everybody knows what competition is. Everybody knows that we live in a competitive world. And yet it turns out that the term competition is used by economists means something quite different from what it means outside the classroom. As a matter of fact, as we should see, it means almost precisely the opposite of what it means outside the classroom. Outside the classroom, competition means the pressure to attempt to do something different from what other people are doing, to do something better. To compete means to try and do something better than what other people are doing. The competitive world is one in which you are continually pressured to do better than others. Businessmen face competition in the sense that there are other people who are going to be doing better than what I'm doing unless I take care. Now, this, in the competitive world of economic theory, it turns out that competition means just the opposite of that. The state of perfect competition is a state where everybody's doing the same thing, where everybody faces the equilibrium price. This is the equilibrium price which people can buy. This is the equilibrium price which people can sell. It's the same price. Everybody's selling the same price. Everybody's buying the same price. Everybody's buying the same good. Everybody's selling the same good. Homogeneous product. Nobody's offering a better commodity. Nobody's offering better service. Nobody's competing by offering lower price. Nobody's competing as buyers by offering to pay a higher price. Nobody's competing on the seller side by offering free delivery or extended credit or longer hours or better lighting or brighter smiles, anything like that. Nobody's doing any of these things. State of competition is a world in which it doesn't pay to do any of these things. You don't need to offer to sell at a lower price. You can sell as much as you want at the going price. You don't need to smile more brightly because you can sell as much as you want with the going quality of smile. You're offering the exact quality of smile of the competitive that is the equilibrium quality for the market. So it turns out that the competitive world of economic theory, is not only a different kind of world than the world outside the market, excuse me, than the world outside the classroom, but it, in fact, is a use of the term competition in a precisely opposite sense from the relevant sense in which students have heard the term used by their parents and by others outside the classroom. To some economists, this is not a matter of embarrassment, this is a matter of self-congratulation. We have something to teach our students. Forget about what competition means outside the classroom. This is a technological, scientific use of the term. In the scientific sense, there is a precise use of the term competition, which is vastly superior to that which the uncultured layman uses in the business world. And after all, economists are entitled to their own jargon. Why not? But there are other difficulties. Besides the terminological difficulties. One important difficulty is that the theory of competition, which is, as we've seen, a theory of equilibrium price, suffers by failing to provide an explanation for how that equilibrium situation might have come about. What tendencies are there, what market forces are there that might tend, in fact, to bring about that particular situation which we describe as as a theory of competition. A theory which is confined to the state of equilibrium, by definition, fails to provide an explanation for the forces which might bring about that state. Theory of competition, then, is not a theory of market price, in the sense of the theory of how the market price is determined, how it might be achieved from some other price. It's a theory of the conditions that would have to be fulfilled if equilibrium were to be maintained. So competition cannot be relied on as an analytical device to explain how price is in fact determined. It is merely an analytical device that would explain how an equilibrium price would in fact fulfill the equilibrium condition, which is not very satisfactory. There is a third difficulty. Take a world in which all sellers are price takers. That is, each individual seller finds a price in the marketplace and simply reacts to it passively, deciding how much he should sell. Or each buyer is a price taker. He finds a price and he reacts to it, deciding simply how much he should buy at that price. Where no individual offers to pay a higher price, but offers to sell at a lower price. Each individual merely reacts to a given price. The price is given on the outside, and each individual in the market is a price taker. He takes the price as given. As we've seen, this involves an equilibrium situation where the price, in fact, is the equilibrium price. But if one focuses attention on what the assumption of price taking really means, it rules out any possible price changes. If no individual can change price, price will not change. See, price is not like the temperature, which in principle happens regardless of what our actions are. Price is something which emerges from our actions. It emerges from the offers to buy and offers to sell. But if none of our actions can possibly alter the price, if each of our actions takes for granted the existence of a given price, then we have ruled out any possibility of offering of the price rising or the price falling. So we have, in fact, ruled out any explanation of how price might tend to gravitate towards an equilibrium price, because we have confined our analysis to a world of pure price takers. So that is a world in which each individual faces horizontal supply and or horizontal demand. Finally, and this difficulty is merely another way of expressing the earlier difficulties, finally, all of the assumption of perfect competition and the competitive equilibrium model can be made internally consistent only by assuming perfect knowledge throughout the market. Only if everybody knows what other people are about to do, will equilibrium emerge. Equilibrium, in fact, is a state of affairs where each individual correctly anticipates what he needs to pay in order to get what he wants. It means he correctly anticipates what others are offering and what others are making available. Only under those conditions where everybody knows, in effect, what other people will be doing, can we make sense of the equilibrium market. So competition, then, in the sense of perfectly competitive model, which is, after all, the core of neoclassical price theory, this model presents great difficulty in that it can get off the ground only by making the assumption, I would say the highly unpalatable assumption, that everybody knows everything that needs to be known in the relevant way. Let me illustrate this by drawing attention to the standard Marshallian graph, the Marshallian supply and demand apparatus. Although what I have to say relates not merely to the world of the single commodity market, it relates to general equilibrium situations even more seriously, I would say, brought out quite clearly in the context of a simple competitive supply and demand analysis.
Here you have your demand curve for a commodity. Here you have your supply curve for a commodity. You're measuring quantity of some commodity on the horizontal axis. And you're measuring prices in units of money on the vertical axis. And here you have your market demand curve. You have your market supply curve. And everybody knows that there's something very exciting about an intersection point. This intersection point is the point of equilibrium, the competitive equilibrium, the equilibrium quantity, and equilibrium price emerge at the intersection point of the supply and demand curve. Now, we can say that that point is unique in the sense that this point is the only point at which the quantity supplied is equal to the quantity demanded. Only at this price level of intersection, these two lines, only at that price is there no discrepancy between the quantity that people wish to buy and the quantity that people wish to sell. Any other price, higher price, people will wish to offer to sell more than people wish to buy, lower price, people wish to buy more than people wish to sell. Fine. One interpretation of the point. We don't usually rest satisfied with making that point. Usually we go further and we argue that that will be the price. That is the equilibrium price. And the equilibrium price might be interpreted to mean that if that were the price, there would be no tendency for the price to move away from it. But we go beyond that. We say not only is that the price which, if attained, would be maintained, we also go ahead and say that will be what the price will turn out to be. But what? Why will the price turn out to be that? See, our competitive theory doesn't really enable us to say that. Our competitive theory points out that if this price were to be attained, the quantity that people should buy at the price would exactly balance the quantity people are prepared to sell. Nobody would be disappointed. Everybody would be able to carry out what they wish to do. And the market would be in equilibrium. At any other price, some people are going to be disappointed. Right? This price, for example, is going to be a surplus. This price is going to be a shortage. It won't be equilibrium because people are going to change. But the statement that this is the only price which is consistent with equilibrium does not by itself give us any assurance that that equilibrium price, if it's not initially occurring, will tend to occur at all. If that price were initially present, there would be no reason for the price to change. But if that price were not the initial price, then what? Are we sure that eventually that will be the price? Well, we usually take it for granted that that will tend to be the price. Price, market price, is going to gravitate towards that intersection price. So why do we say that? What grounds do we have for making that statement? We cannot, you see, rely on the theory of perfect competition. Because the theory of perfect competition, after all, is a theory which imagines that we are already here. Theory of perfect competition represents a situation where anybody who wants to buy at the going price can buy. Doesn't find there's a shortage. Everybody who wants to sell at the going price can sell and doesn't find that he has less than unsold goods. But that's the situation at the equilibrium. Now, if that were, that equilibrium position were attained already, fine. But the problem is, it goes into another sense, a theory of competition, assuming as it does perfect knowledge, doesn't give us any clue as to why on earth that equilibrium position, if it's not initially occurring, would tend to happen. Now, in our economics courses, we generally introduce some elementary dynamics. We say, look, supposing the price were to be higher than the equilibrium price. Okay? Quantity offered to sell, offered to be sold, which was greater than the quantity that people are prepared to buy at the price. Surplus? What happens when there's a surplus? Well, everybody knows that when there's a surplus, the price tends to fall. And everybody knows that when there's a shortage, the price tends to rise. Now, this is fine as far as it goes, but what does it rest on? It doesn't rest on the theory of perfect competition. Because the theory of perfect competition assumes that you had equilibrium in the first place. Moreover, what is the rationale for arguing that the price will fall? As soon as you say the price will fall, you're escaping from the assumption. assumption of everybody being plastic. If the price can't fall with everybody being a plastic, everybody assumes this is the price, this will be the price. If everybody takes for granted that this is the price, this will be the price. If everybody continues to take for granted that will be the price, that will be the price. Surplus or no surplus? Why does surplus require the price fall? Surplus requires the price fall because somebody changes the price. Somebody with unsold goods lowers the price.
So as soon as he said that, as soon as he said that somebody with unsold goods offers to sell for a lower price, you are violating the assumption that everybody's a price taker.
You're saying that some people do not take the price for granted, do not react passively to given price, and in fact go out of their way to affect the price. Somebody realizes that in order to sell, he's going to have to offer to sell at a lower price, and he will go out and do so. He will offer to sell at a lower price. Competition between sellers will in fact force down the price.
Probably use the same competition in different sense now, haven't they?
If there are sellers with unsold goods that are trying to get rid of their goods, and they will compete with each other to get rid of those goods, they're competing not in the sense of perfect competition, but competing in the sense of the term which freshmen bring into the university so that it turns out that this elementary dynamic that price falls when it's a surplus requires us to violate the conditions of perfect competition as used technically in the classroom and requires us to revert to a notion of competition which we import from outside the classroom. So it requires us to overstep the boundaries of competitive theory. So the theory which tells us that this will be the equilibrium price cannot be described as a theory of perfect competition. The theory which requires us to transcend the theory of perfect competition. Now, hold on for a moment. There are a number of difficulties with this. First of all, the very notion of a single price at which everybody is initially prepared to buy and to sell or thinks he's able to buy and sell unlimited quantities. This initial notion raises certain difficulties. Just what is without equilibrium, why on earth should there be a single price? A single price is not something that we can take for granted. A single price, if it occurs at all, must be postulated as being the result of an equilibrating market process. But the market will not tolerate for a long time many prices for the same commodity. Why not? Clearly, those who are selling for the lower price will tend to sell for the higher price, those who are selling for the higher price will tend to sell for the lower price, and so forth. There will be market forces tending to compress prices for the same commodity to a single narrow band. But that's the result of an equilibrating crisis. That's not something to take for granted. If we start out with the assumption that there is a single price, we are, in a very important way, begging the question, are we not? Moreover, we started out by saying that initially everybody was a price taker, and consequently at the going price, buyers decided at an aggregate they would want to buy that quantity, sellers decided at an aggregate they would want to sell that quantity. So we started out with the assumption that everybody knew what the price was, and in fact that was the price. But everybody knew, or thought they knew, that he could sell as much as he wanted at that price, and buy as much as he wanted at that price. But it turns out that was wrong. It wasn't. It wasn't true that individuals could sell as much as they wanted at that price. So we are violating one of the initial conditions, which says that there was perfect knowledge, there was not perfect knowledge. Argued before, perfect knowledge implies equilibrium. As soon as you talk about a situation outside equilibrium, you have to violate the assumption of perfect knowledge. Perfect knowledge would mean immediate equilibrium. If you want to start out by talking about a disequilibrium situation, you have to violate the condition. You have to assume that there was not perfect knowledge. So Dennis Robertson once said that the only reason why we draw demand supply curves big like that is because the people in the back of the class should be able to see what's going on. What he meant was that really the only relevant point, the only relevant range of the diagram is the range right around the point of equilibrium. But I think the point goes further than that. I think the only point to which this diagram is relevant at all is the point of intersection. All we have is the point of intersection, the rest will be erased. What that means is that if you're there, you're there, and if you're not there, you're not there. The because do notice, what do we mean by a point on the supply curve? We mean a point which shows the aggregate quantities that people will be prepared to sell at a given price. It means that if the price is this is what people in aggregate will wish to sell. But why will the price be there? Well, the price would be there only if there was a demand curve passing through there, and this would be the price that would be an equilibrium price, and that would be a point of the supply. Every point on the supply curve really has meaning only on the hypothesis that there was a demand curve. Conversely, every point in the demand curve has meaning only if we can hypothesize where the supply curve happens. But in fact, there's only one point where you have both a supply curve and a demand curve. That's the only real point on either curve, isn't it? Any other point violates the initial condition. Any point other than the intersection and the intersection violates the initial condition by which we set up the curves in the first place. Because when we set up a demand curve, we ask ourselves, well, supposing a buyer found that this was the price, how much would he wish to buy, add it up to all potential buyers, and you get a point in your market demand curve. But that notion that you can assume that there's a given horizontal price line, a given horizontal supply curve facing each individual buyer, as we said earlier, assumes equilibrium. So equilibrium occurs only at a point of intersection. So it's true we can draw a demand curve, the meaning of each point of which, a hypothetical meaning. That is, where is the supply curve attached to that point that would be officially over? But as in fact there is only one point at which supply and demand intersect, there is really only one point there. Now, so far I've been analyzing the elementary dynamics that we teach in the classroom based on sort of a horizontal line situation, what's sometimes called Walrasian dynamics, where you focus attention on particular price and ask, is this price in equilibrium? If not, the price is below equilibrium, there's a shortage that drives price up. The price is above equilibrium, the price drives price down. You can write equations, dynamic equations, which show that the rate of price change is a function of the excess supply and demand. And we've pointed out some of the inconsistencies of this kind of dynamic. What about Marshallian dynamics? Marshallian dynamics operates by asking different kind of questions. The Marshallian dynamics doesn't focus attention on different prices, asking whether there would be surpluses and shortages at these prices, and whether these shortages and surpluses would generate prices. Rather, the Marshallian dynamics focuses attention on quantity. At this quantity, there is a demand price and there is a supply price. Now, the demand price means that you are referring to the highest price, which is sufficiently low to attract buyers to buy up that total quantity. That is, label this as point A, this point is T sub A, and T sub A is the demand price for the quantity OA, meaning that any price higher than T sub A is insufficiently low to attract buyers to buy that quantity. You can
think of this as a range of prices which are low prices going higher and higher and higher until we reach the highest price which is sufficiently low to attract buyers to buy that quantity.
Any price higher than that will drive some buyers away so you won't get rid of that quantity. Similarly, if the supply price refers to the lower limit of the prices which are sufficiently high to attract sellers in aggregate, offer to sell that particular quantity. And what Marshallian dynamics in essence says is that so long as the demand price exceeds the supply price, there is incentive for quantity to expand.
Because as you can see, there is a range in which the prices that buyers are prepared to pay, the highest prices that the buyers are prepared to pay, exceed the lowest prices that are sufficient to attract sellers to sell. And that
would mean that there is incentive for buyers, for sellers and buyers to get together to
connect them. So long as there is a surplus of
demand price, an excess in demand price over the supply. So long as that excess exists, quantity would expand. Were quantity to be to the right of the intersection point, you see,
then something wrong here. The demand price is lower than the supply price. That is, the highest price, which is supposed to be low to attract buyers to buy, isn't anywhere near as high enough to the lowest price, which is supposed to be
high to attract sellers to sell. Therefore, there is no price for those quantities that will simultaneously provide incentives for those buyers to buy and sellers to sell. Those quantities will not happen. Therefore, if they did happen, there'll be a tendency for those quantities the next period to not be produced, not to be offered for sale. But this dynamics, the Marshallian-type dynamics, assumes that in some way the market knows where the demand price is and the market knows where the supply price is. That again assumes a kind of perfect knowledge which is inconsistent with this equilibrium condition. So, this illustrates, I think, the difficulties which Austrian economists have with a standard approach to competition. It's an approach which I think has to be confined to a state of equilibrium. It has an important function to fulfill in analyzing the state of equilibrium. I don't wish to dismiss it out of hand as being of no value at all. It has great value in terms of the analysis of equilibrium situations, but it seems to be entirely meaningless as soon as one steps out of the state of equilibrium and tries to understand what forces in fact operate on market prices to determine what those prices will tend to be. And this brings me then to the Austrian alternative. The Austrian alternative, in a way, is closer to the layman's view of what goes on in the market. Now, Professor Stiegel of the University of Chicago wrote an important paper many years ago on the history of the theory of competition. If I can sum up rather crudely the story which Stiegel presented, it was that in the beginning there was a crude concept of competition, which economists held. This concept, the concept of competition as rivalry. This concept gradually became refined until, in the hands of Frank Knight, Stiegel's teacher, the concept became a precise concept, a refined analytical concept, the concept of perfect competition. So you have then a historical view which sees competition theory as being a continuous upward analytical movement from a crude rivalrous notion of competition to a refined scientific notion of competition as a state of affairs. Stiegel was taken to task by later writers who pointed out that it's not that the earlier rivalrous concept of competition was gradually refined into the notion of competition as a state of affairs. Rather, what happened was that the earlier notion of competition as a rivalrous process was replaced by an entirely different notion of competition as a state of affairs. This is important. For Adam Smith, competition meant rivalry. We mentioned earlier that there's a surplus. Sellers will be on their toes, competing with each other, trying to get rid of their goods. They're offered to sell at lower prices, the price will fall. Now that's a different notion of competition from the notion of competition as a state of affairs. And the notion which, according to Stiegler, was rendered precise by Frank and I. And, for Austria, competition in the marketplace requires us to return to that original Adam Smith's notion or layman's notion of competition as a process. What is a competitive process? What is competition when it is seen in the sense of process? Competitive process is the kind of series of changes which occur when individuals are free to do better for the market, to provide better opportunities for the market than are currently being provided. Where at the same time, each participant in the market feels under pressure to try and do that, because he's aware that if he doesn't do the best he can for the market, others will get ahead of him. Now, that very crude notion of competition, but a very vital notion of competition, is at the core of the Austrian analysis of market processes. Now, the very emphasis that Austrian economics places on competition as a process brings with it a related emphasis on market process as distinct from market equilibrium. For Austrians, understanding the market does not consist in understanding the conditions that would have to be fulfilled for the market to be in equilibrium. For Austrians, to understand the market means to understand the forces that are operating at all times on market decisions that may or may not tend to lead towards the equilibrium position. But at any rate, are certainly not confined to analysis of already assumed sustained equilibrium states of affairs. For example, in Austrian economics, we don't take the notion of a single price as something to start out with. We take the notion of a single price as something that can be shown to tend to happen. The notion of a single price goes back to Jevons over 100 years ago. He called it the law of indifference. Now, the law of indifference does not mean for Austrians that we start out by saying there has to be a single price. But for us it means that we understand that there are at all times powerful forces tending to eliminate price discrepancies for the same commodity. These forces are pretty clear for us to understand. We understand what these forces are. If at any point in time there are more than one price for the same commodity, as we mentioned earlier, there will be incentive for these differences to be discovered and taken advantage of. Now, the point of view is sometimes taken that there can't be more than one price for the same commodity. Because if there were, there would have been the possibility for pure entrepreneurial profit. It would have been taken already, which would have bid up the price for the where the price had been low and bid down the price where the price would have been high. Now, it's fine to recognize that if there would have been more than one price, there would have been pure entrepreneurial profit opportunities, and that we can rely on these to be discovered and acted on. But we cannot assume at all times that all the profit opportunities have already been acted on. We have to incorporate in our analysis. We have to build our analysis around the way in which, in fact, entrepreneurial opportunities are discovered and are then acted on. So we see that there is a powerful tendency for prices to converge to a single price. But we see this tendency as a tendency which is fueled by entrepreneurial discovery, fueled by the profit incentive, fueled by competition in the sense of a process. That is, where I find that I can buy at 5 and sell at 10, I will try and do so. But there are others trying to do so. All of us try and buy at 5 and try and sell at 10. This will mean that some of us will realize that the way to do it is to try and buy at 6 and sell at 9. And as this goes on, the price will tend to converge somewhere between 6 and 9. But this is a result of an equilibrating process. The essence of the market is seen as consisting in this process, not as consisting in the state of equilibrium that might possibly result from that process. Another way of emphasizing this is to interpret the equilibrating process as a process of discovery. We criticize the standard approach to theory of competition by its assumption that knowledge is perfect to start out with. To start out with perfect knowledge assumption is, after all, to beg so much of what the real question is. So we would like to escape from the constraint of having to assume knowledge to be perfect in the first place. And it turns out, very interestingly, that the equilibrating process, or more generally, the market process, turns out to be a process of discovery. The relationship between process and equilibrium is exactly parallel to the relationship between discovery and perfect knowledge. Perfect knowledge in the state of affairs when everything that needs to be discovered has already been discovered. But what is surely of interest to economists is to understand what the process of discovery is, so that we can perhaps help to comment on what kinds of institutions will facilitate discovery, what kinds of institutions will facilitate the discovery of error, the discovery of new information that might bring about the perfect knowledge condition. But to start out by assuming the perfect knowledge condition, this begs the question of very essential work. So if Austrians are not prepared to assume that everything takes care of itself, and that somehow or other we know everything, everybody knows everything, and somehow or other we are already in a perfectly competitive equilibrium situation, we would like to focus attention on precisely what happens during the disequilibrium phases of the market process. In fact, we are interested in the market process. For us, competition is then not a state of affairs, and the market is relevant not primarily as a set of equilibrium conditions. For us, competition is a rivalrous process, and markets are relevant precisely in the systematic movement which market price tends to display as a result of the discovery process, which is set in motion by rivalrous competition. So in a world of a single commodity, how would an Austrian approach the analysis? Well, he would say, in the beginning, there is no single price. It doesn't make sense that what would happen if the price was above equilibrium or below equilibrium. Initially, imagine this is a market, and this is a market for apples. Initially, no one of us knows what the market price is. No one of us knows, certainly, what the equilibrium market price is. We begin to grope in the dark. Some of us offer to sell apples at high prices. Some of us offer to sell apples at low prices. Some of us offer to buy prices at high apples. Some of us offer to buy apples at high prices. Some of us offer to buy apples at low prices. Some of us discover that we bought apples at a price higher than what our neighbor bought apples at. Some of us discover that we sold apples at prices which are lower than the price which our neighbor sold apples at. We won't make that mistake again. We revise our estimation of what the eagerness of buyers is to buy, what the eagerness of sellers is to sell. The point is, in the beginning, we don't know. None of us know. And the market process is a process of discovery. We discover how eager other people are to buy and or to sell by interaction, by market experience. Some of us discover that we refuse to buy apples at a low price because we thought there was an even lower price available. Well, we discover that there was. The next time around, we don't pass up that attractive opportunity to buy apples at a low price. Sell apples, that is, some of us were offered prices for apples that were very attractive, high prices. But we didn't accept those prices, we didn't sell at those prices, because we thought we could get even higher prices. As it turns out, we couldn't. So next time around, when that offer confronts us, we'll take advantage of it. Now, this is a process of learning by experience, of learning by experience with other market participants. It's a process which is systematic, because one learns that one's information yesterday, or one's guesses yesterday, were perhaps wrong, one guesses the direction in which a revision is required. One has discovered that the market was not as eager as we thought. One has discovered the market was more eager than we thought. So that the decisions taken on any one day, not by price takers, but by individuals who are fully conscious of competitive pressures, fully conscious that there's no point in offering to pay a low price for apples if there are others who are prepared to pay higher prices. And this process of discovery, this process of learning about the preparedness of other market participants to offer and to bid, this experience is a systematic one which leads to equilibrating processes. Generalizing from a single commodity market to a market to many markets, to markets linked horizontally, to markets linked vertically, to the relationship between factor market, market for resources, and commodity markets, markets for produced products, and realizes that the process is exactly the same kind. If the sum of resource prices necessary to produce some product is lower than the price of the product, this can only mean that sellers of resources or unaware knowledge can be marshaled and organized to communicate with decision makers the information which they lack. This, of course, is where the entrepreneurial profit motive comes in. It's the motive which switches on the alertness of different individuals to opportunities that others have hitherto overlooked. Well, I've gone on perhaps a little too long. Let me try and sum up very briefly. The Austrian approach to competition in the market process is that these two are inseparable. Competition is a notion which relates strictly to market process. Market process can be postulated to occur in a systematic way only under the force of rivalrous competition.
The kinds of revisions which Austrian economists would like to see in standard price theory is then the relegation of perfectly competitive theory to a much more subordinate position as a special case where, as a result, presumably, of some discovery process, we're entitled to analyze the state of affairs that might eventually, perhaps, emerge when discovery, as a result of rigorous competition, has successfully been carried out to completion. Of course, long before such a process would have run its course, the basic underlying data which define the next state of equilibrium would have changed. We live in a kaleidic world, as Shackle has described it, a world in which the underlying data never stay put for long enough for the state of equilibrium really to be relevant. But nonetheless, the analysis of states of equilibrium is a fine exercise, but it cannot provide a substitute for the really important content of economics, which should surely be the understanding of how market processes in fact work. Thank you very much.
Professor Kirzner has to leave promptly at 3 p.m. to catch an airplane, but we have 10 minutes for questions, so I'll just turn it back over to him, but I'll cut him off about 3 o'clock, because he doesn't want to spend any more time in Boulder than he has to. He wants to go back to New York's Manhattan or that place.
I know what you think of Manhattan. Yes. Could you speak up, please? I'm not sure if I understand your question right, but let me try, and you'll answer me. You'll tell me if I'm not giving the right answer, not answering the right question. The change of emphasis from equilibrium economics to crisis economics requires a concomitant change in one's notion of what we're trying to get out of the market. If we deal with the state of affairs, then the crucial question is the state of affairs an efficient one or an inefficient one? That is, could one conceivably devise an alternative configuration of production, the utilization of resources, that would in some sense make society better off? If one focuses attention not on states of equilibrium, or states of affairs at all, but on processes, the question then is not on whether a particular state of affairs is efficient or not. That is not on whether hypothetically one could think of a better world. Rather, the focus of attention should surely be on what incentives are there for existing inefficiencies to be as rapidly as possible discovered and corrected. That's a different focus. And I, although this wasn't the
the subject of today's talk, but I certainly agree that an important implication of this is that it requires us to alter our focus of normative attention. That is, our attention as normative economists would not be on whether a state of affairs is efficient or not, as standard welfare economics tries to do, but rather would require us to focus attention on the flexibility of decisions and the responsiveness of decisions, the ability of decisions to detect, discover, and move to correct existing inefficiencies, which at any one time certainly would exist. Yes? Yeah, that is, it plays no role. In a market, the government plays no role other than as one of those who are buying or one of those who are selling. A government may, of course, be a monopolist of one kind, as a monopolist buyer, a monopolist seller, in which case both the neoclassical kind of theory and Austrian economics is one of which would apply. Mostly, governments come into the picture as being extra market agents, agents that operate outside the market because they operate not through voluntary exchanges, but through the use of tax revenues, or the use of regulations. But to the extent that governments participate in markets without monopolization, they would enter along with everybody else. Government production and government allocation would tend to be an alternative to markets. So if one wishes to evaluate the relative usefulness of these alternatives, government or markets, then an important question would be, well, what do markets do, as opposed to what the governments do? What I would argue is that if you want to understand what the market does, for whatever purposes, including the particular purpose of comparing it with alternative institutional arrangements, you have to understand what I would argue to be the important functions and contributions of the market, namely its ability to initiate systematic processes, rather than its ability somehow or other to faultlessly grind out equilibrium solutions. The market sometimes being described as a computer. Market is a computer analogy. And there is something which I think is unfortunate about that analogy, in that the market, in fact, does not operate as a computer. Because you get out of a computer what you feed into it. And if you start out by assuming that everything is known, then all that is required is a computation of the relevant solution. Whereas in a market, the initial assumption must be that, in fact, nobody knows everything. That, in fact, there is an enormous amount of ignorance strewn around. And the function of the market then is not to grind out the computed solution to a fully articulated problem. But the function of the market is, in fact, to draw out the bits of information that would be necessary in principle before one could even begin to discuss the way in which the solution might be computed. So this new approach has, I would say, important implications both for normative economics as such and for the way in which you might wish to understand what a market does as compared with alternative institutions, for example, government. Yes?
I can understand the distinction you're trying to draw. Can you paint in broad brushstrokes the kinds of errors that have been based on the equilibrium concept of competition? Use that as a foundation of your economic system. What kind of problems does that lead to?
Let me just illustrate by a couple of examples. One example would be the economics of advertising. Within a framework of competitive equilibrium, advertising has no role. It has no role because everyone is assumed to know everything. There's no information required. There is no rivalrous competition required. And in fact, advertising is perceived as a violation of competitive conditions. Advertising is then labeled as being monopolistic. In fact, I think you and I know that the way you compete, one of the ways you compete is by advertising. Advertising is one of the avenues for competitive activity, for rivalrous competitive activity. Now, I think the inability to see the market process as a rivalrous process, to see competition in that sense,
been responsible, was responsible for a long time in a complete misunderstanding of the role of advertising in a market economy. This does not sort of justify advertising as such or justify advertising messages. It merely points out to the role of advertising in a competitive sense rather than the way it's been built as being anti-competitive. It's not anti-competitive. It's the way in which one competes. Another implication of standard economics would be its attitude towards the antitrust. Within a framework which sees competition as a state of affairs, competition means the state of affairs where you have many infinitesimally small buyers and sellers. And in fact, if there is a small number of sellers, then the assumption is that competition doesn't exist, because you don't have the conditions for competition. But surely competition in the rivalry sense does not evaporate simply because you have few numbers. Now, few numbers may lead to collusion, certainly. But unless collusion occurs, and if you have collusion, of course you have monopoly. But unless you have collusion, the fact that there are a small number of sellers doesn't by any means eliminate the possibility of rivalrous competition between those several members, so several oligopolists. Right? Competition in the process sense is fully consistent with the small numbers. This, I think, throws an entirely different light on the social function of antitrust. If one sees the task of antitrust to restore competition and understand by competition the state of equilibrium, state of perfectly competitive equilibrium, you're likely to frustrate, you're likely, first of all, to overlook the rivalrous processes that are by no means eliminated, may be, in fact, accelerated in the market where you have few firms, where you have price wars and so forth, where competition is extremely vigorous. And it's that kind of competition which we rely on, surely, to discover opportunities and to eliminate slack. These would be examples of implications to standard approach, which I think us in economics would tend to escape.
Thank you very much, Professor Krugman.